This is MSCI Perspectives, bringing to light insights and analysis that help global investors tackle today's challenges. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is November 7th, 2024. Asset owners, including pension funds and sovereign wealth funds, for example, well, they're arguably the ones who set the direction for all other investors. And each year, for the last 19 years anyway, MSCI has gathered a select group of these investors to discuss the most pressing investment issues of the day, as well as how to move forward to address them. We at Perspectives had the opportunity to speak with two attendees of this year's forum. Now, they just happened to be Axel Killian, MSCI's Chief Client Officer, as well as MSCI's Chief Research Officer and friend of the pod, Ashley Lester. I don't think it's going out too far on a limb to say that events like these and the insights they yield, they play a very important role. And the reason they're so important is that they, you know what? Why don't I let Axel explain?
The reason why it is really important, the two most important asset owners in California are co-hosting the event together with MSCI, so it's CalPERS and CalSTRS, and together they have about $1 trillion in assets under management, and they have a major responsibility towards the pensioners in public service and towards the teachers. And it's an event where very sophisticated investors are meeting and exchanging ideas how to get to better risk return outcomes from an investment perspective.
And as Ashley continued,
the world of investment is constantly changing. New themes are constantly arising, new questions, new risks, new opportunities. And probably the organizations in the world that are at the absolute forefront of this are some of the world's largest and most sophisticated asset owners. Institutions like CalPERS and CalSTRS, for instance, on the West Coast, or some of the big Canadian pension funds. So a forum like this, when a set of the world's most influential investors can come together to discuss in common the problems and risks and opportunities that they face, is really an opportunity for the world's leading investors to set their agenda for the years to come.
The theme of the forum this year was total portfolio allocation. You'll hear it throughout today's episode as TPA. Now, a TPA approach differs from what you might know more as a traditional strategic asset allocation approach, which
involves essentially the management of a pension fund committing alongside the board to a particular asset allocation, 80% equities, 20% bonds, or whatever. And then the job of the management is, by choosing the right managers within any given asset class, to do their best to outperform that 80-20 allocation or whatever it might be. In a TPA approach instead, the management presents to the board what the end investment objective is. Instead of the input, i.e. 80-20, they present an objective. Our job is to get 7% returns year on year with no greater than X percent drawdown, or whatever their investment objective might be. And now it's up to management to construct a whole portfolio out of potentially many different building blocks to achieve that objective. And that's the basis on which they're held to be accountable to their board. So why might the world be shifting from a simple asset class allocation type framework to this framework, which ultimately gives more discretion to the management of the institution? Well, that's because of the increasing complexity we see in the investment world. First off, we see more asset classes now than we did before. Instead of just public equities and public fixed income, we've got public equities, traditional fixed income, private equities, private credit, infrastructure. So we've got a whole proliferation of different asset classes, which makes it much harder to sort of pre-commit to a single simple asset allocation. Alongside of that, institutional asset owners are aware that because the world is changing and it's dynamic, we really need to think through longer term scenarios about stuff that we've never seen before, whether that takes the form of climate change or AI or some of the important geopolitical shifts that we're seeing in the world. And so in order to manage those, management of an asset owner needs the flexibility to shift around between these asset classes on a more opportunistic basis. So the learning that we take from the shift that we've seen in some of the leading institutions is the importance of putting in place an appropriate governance framework and an appropriate culture at a major asset owner such that management can take on board the extra discretion that they're being given, and the board can still feel that they're fulfilling their fiduciary duties in giving this discretion to management. So it's not just a simple matter of changing an investment policy here or there. It's a matter of really fundamentally reshaping the governance and the culture of institutions.
The cultural aspect was one very interesting takeaway for me when I heard reports back from Sacramento. What do you think's behind that?
Some of that comes down to just how difficult the world of investment is. Pretty much anyone is going to go through periods when the investment choices they've made are not working out for them. And that is a testing period for an investor, no matter who they are or what type of institution they work at. And in those testing periods, investment teams can either pull together to draw the right signals and make the right decisions about how to improve their investment performance, or they can descend into squabbling about whose fault it is that they're in this hole in the first place. And so any investor who has lived through those types of drawdowns is therefore really deeply aware of the importance of pulling together a team that is so committed to a central philosophy and a central objective that they will continue working towards that and delivering towards that through thick and through thin.
That all makes perfect sense, but are asset owners taking this message to heart when it applies to a TPA approach? I asked Axel about how seriously he felt MSCI clients were taking the issue.
I think very seriously, but it requires leadership. So in the case of these two institutions,
the two institutions Axel is referring to are CalPERS and CalSTRS, who
both recently appointed new chief investment officers, very experienced. Scott Chan comes from CalSTRS, so he knows the firm. He has worked as deputy CIO, so he has worked with all the investment teams. Stephen Gilmore at CalPERS recently joined, and he had implemented it. He had experience how to best put it in place. And they have worked through that, but they were both in the meetings, in the interviews, very clear that culture is of critical importance and that you need to bring these teams together and incentivize them to work as one team. Undoubtedly, the TPA approach makes sense from an investment perspective. This came out very clearly in my interview with Scott Chan. He explained really well why this makes sense. So if you look at it within an asset class, of course, it makes then sense to allocate the last dollar in this asset class in the best investment opportunity, not on the basis whether it's public or private.
Okay, so we've established that a focus on culture is key to successfully implementing a TPA approach. And it sounds like that's something asset owners are definitely taking very seriously. But what are some of the other forces that investors are contending with? Now, Ashley brought up some of these earlier when he spoke about geopolitical risk, the rise of AI, and accounting for climate change. We will get back to those, but first, let's talk about one that was a major topic of discussion at the forum. That is the growing allocation to private assets. Axel made reference to that aspect just now, so why don't we start with my discussion with him?
What are you hearing from clients in general about how they are working to integrate private assets into this portfolio?
Yeah, so of course, private assets have performed extremely well. People talk about illiquidity premium that you can capture in private markets. Now, more recently, in particular in private equity, we have seen that anticipated exits did not happen, with implications. If you run a public pension fund and you have liabilities, you always need to ensure that you have enough liquidity. And here, it's probably fair to say that then the combination in the total plan approach between public and private assets helps to overcome these liquidity issues. However, this then goes at the expense of the public market investment. This will then be taken as a liquidity source. And that's where I think also from a total plan perspective, a benefit comes from, that you can still make a significant allocation into, let's say, equities or into the credit bucket, because you have one part where you know you have a liquid secondary market.
Is the direction of travel then maybe to the place where you're not thinking private equity and public equity, but just
equities? Correct. Absolutely. And this Stephen Gilmore explained really well. So when you think about it from a research perspective, you analyze private companies, you analyze public companies. But if you separate the buckets in your investment approach, your last dollar might go into a not optimal investment from a total plan approach. And that resonated with me, and this is why this makes sense. Also, I think it's more efficient to look at it from a research perspective as one. It's the same valuation drivers, whether a company is public or private. You look at the balance sheet and you look at the sector they are in, and you compare within the sector.
Ashley came to this question from a similar but certainly not identical perspective. He spoke about the need to
break up the rise of private assets into their component classes, or their principal component classes, those being private equity, infrastructure, and private credit. In the case of private equity, we've seen sustained growth in private equity over recent years. And so major asset owners have seen this and they have been drawn to that. On the supply side, we could think about the role of Wise Technology, the rise of new technology, fostering the rise of new companies that wish to stay private. We could think about changing regulations that public companies face. So there's probably a set of demand side factors as well. But for investors, really, this boils down to the fact that over the last 15 years, private equity has generally outperformed public. And that has drawn in more and more investors and therefore more and more funds, and it's become kind of self-fulfilling in some sense. In the case of private credit, the initial impetus here seems pretty clearly to come from post-financial crisis regulations, which have restricted the ability of banks to take risk in the ways that they used to take risk. And so we've seen a transfer of risk from bank balance sheets towards funds operated by private credit companies. And in some sense, you'd have to say that this looks like a socially beneficial transfer risk. Bank balance sheets are very highly leveraged and they have a duration mismatch. In other words, as everyone knows, banks borrow money that's available very quickly, i.e. deposits, and they lend it out on long-term loans. And if the depositors get flighty, then we see big problems. Funds don't fundamentally suffer from that problem. That's not the same thing as saying that there will never be any problems in private credit, of course. It's just that if one has to extend credit somewhere, probably this is a safer place to put it systemically than in banks. And so that probably is a perhaps intended result of post-GFC regulation that's pushed the rise of private credit, and we'll probably continue to see more. And then lastly, infrastructure, I think, has probably risen as an asset class because of a combination of limited ability of governments to fund new infrastructure on the first part, so the need for to bring private money into that. And I think we'll see continued growth in infrastructure because of the continued need to deal with climate change or to fund the transition to low carbon energy sources.
So the rise of private assets, that overlaps with the need to deal with climate change. Ashley went on to speak about how he sees links across a number of the challenges facing investors, but that
the links across climate change and geopolitics are particularly apparent. The world committed to trying to achieve a 1.5 degree increase in temperature relative to pre-industrial level. The UN has just come out and basically said, that's gone. MSCI recently commissioned research or undertook research with a wide selection of well-informed asset managers and asset owners about their expected degree of climate change. The median answer was about 1.9 degrees, close to 2 degrees of climate change, with a third or more of investors expecting 3 degrees or more. So the news is overall bad for how much climate change is going to happen. As that climate change happens, we're going to see all sorts of dislocations in the physical environment which humans inhabit. We already see, even in a place like the States, more and more areas that are uninsurable for homeowners. We saw in the week just before the Sacramento conference, two devastating hurricanes in 2 weeks sweep through Florida. We've seen prolonged droughts in California. The list goes on. And this is just in the United States. So now take that degree of stress and apply that to areas whose governance and economy frameworks are not strong enough to support that, like many parts of the American continent south of the US border. And straight away, you can start to see the potential for population movements and the attendant political stresses around them. Within countries, you can see stresses around water rights usage across different states, for instance, within the US. You can see changes in arable land areas and the consequent squabbles about those across countries. So we're stressing the physical environment. By stressing the physical environment in which we all live, we're inevitably going to cause population or power shifts across countries, which will cause heightened geopolitical tension.
To recap, when it comes to the non-culture-related challenges that asset owners are facing, the ones that Ashley told forum attendees are creating, quote, greater investment complexity and greater black swan risk than was generally appreciated in the 1990s and early 2000s, we've so far spoken about the rise of private assets, climate change, and geopolitics. The last item on this list, well, I'm going to guess it comes as no surprise.
So the rise of AI, I think, is going to have profound implications for all of us, no matter what we do in society. And they're very likely to be almost inconceivable to us at the moment in the literal sense that is very difficult for us to think about exactly in what ways life will be transformed or societies or economies will be transformed by AI, in much the same way that even the most visionary kind of person involved in the internet in 2000 probably would have struggled to think about the various forms the development of the internet has led to. So we really don't know what's coming. So that's certainly a rise of a new and unanticipated type of risk. In terms of what we do know is coming more specifically for investors, there are some really significant implications here. The first and most obvious, perhaps the least exciting, is this is a really important new industry. And so investors want to figure out, well, how can I invest in it in such a way that I'm going to make money? So that's pretty obvious. The second is, how can AI change our understanding of financial assets and returns? And it can do that in a number of ways, but fundamentally it can do that by turning words into data and then back again into words. And so that means that we can develop new types of quantitative models that potentially can capture the risks of investments with respect to the words used to describe companies. So we might be able to capture the risks of private investments with respect to the specific partners who are involved in deals, for instance. Or we might better be able to describe the activities of companies and the types of themes to which they're exposed by reading all sorts of documentation about the company. So it changes the information set available to investors. And that's going to have a profound impact. And then lastly, it will have a profound impact on the work that investors do. And again, this is all about its capacity to change words into numbers and back again by changing how quickly investors can access quantitative information about the investments they've already made. An example is, instead of getting a giant risk report at 8 o'clock in the morning, typically risk reports come in the form of sort of 300-page PDFs in 6-point font. Investors can instead expect to wake up in the morning with a neatly written summary of just the parts of their portfolio to which they need to pay attention, why they need to pay attention to it, and potentially some things they might want to do about it. And that completely changes the use of numbers and the risk models in the investment process itself. That's a change which, by the way, is already here because we at MSCI launched it.
Regular listeners to this program will know that we try to end each episode with a look ahead of sorts. And even though Ashley scolded during our interview that...
That's a very mean question, Adam.
We're going to end this episode in exactly that same way. More specifically, contemplating how asset owners may be focusing as they work to meet the challenges that we've discussed with Ashley and Axel through the rest of this year and into 2025. Now, one note, our interviews took place on October 31st, so we didn't yet know the outcome of the U.S. elections. Nonetheless, Axel's response began by noting...
That's obviously one where asset owners think about the implications. Regardless what the outcome is, it will have implications on geopolitics. Then there is probably the question from an interest rate environment, from an inflation perspective. It's the typical things. How do you position your portfolio into 2025 and beyond? Obviously, equity markets had a significant run have outperformed. Also, the public markets have outperformed private markets significantly on the basis of these superior performance from the Magnificent Seven. On the other hand, this causes a problem. You have a concentration risk. So this is something that asset owners definitely look into. We had some discussions in Sacramento on the day before the conference with some investors and how to handle that. What I took away is people are still not prepared to take a bet against the market.
I think it will be interesting to observe next year whether some of the fast moving forces that we've talked about, in particular around geopolitics and around how politics interacts with fiscal and monetary policy, how will that impact markets and what effect will that have on the way in which some of these long-term trends are playing out? Give you two examples. In terms of AI, for example, will governments decide that this is a force that increasingly needs to be regulated? And in that case, in what way will that change the future of AI? And second, as a number of governments around the world face severe and increasing fiscal deficits, and in particular, the prospect of severe and increasing fiscal deficits here in the US, very likely, regardless of whoever wins the election, what implications will that have for the stability of markets and the directions of interest rates over the course of next year? And some of those apparently short-term pressures, by the way, have big structural consequences. Higher interest rates, for various reasons, make it harder to fund the transition to low carbon economy. So again, what we see is the connection of these tectonic forces kind of pushing together and creating new and unexpected shapes as we proceed.
That's all for this week. Our thanks to Axel and Ashley and to all of you for listening. For more insights focused on helping asset owners as well as other investors meet the challenges we've discussed, please visit the Research and Insights section of MSCI.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspectives.